So welcome, everyone. It's good to see you again. Is there anybody here for the first time tonight? So good. So you all know what's going to happen, so I won't go over that again. But we do have a new discussion leader with us tonight. I wanted to thank all the graduate students who are leading the discussions. I think I forgot to thank you last time, especially like this is right before their break. They might wish to be somewhere else. So really thank you so much for being here. And Sonia, who led the discussion group, she could only come for the first two times. So tonight we're joined by Miriam Zaman. So she'll wave and she's gonna be joining us for the next three sessions. I know you'll enjoy getting to know her. She's a doctoral student in anthropology. What else would I need to tell you tonight? Oh, we have a little new variation on the questions and answers. We have some index cards that if you want to ask a question, you know, basically anonymously, you don't want to raise your hand and ask, but you can put it on an index card and we'll collect them after the discussion period and give them to Dr. Khalil. So that's just another way to ask a question. And it looks like we have a smaller group tonight, I think because of the weather. So and spring break for the students, yeah, the spring break is just about starting. So we'll see. I think we should have enough people in each discussion group, but if not, I might combine them. So let's just, that might happen. Okay, and I think the last thing I wanted to mention is, you know, we've been doing a lot of reading. The last book, and I love the last book, there's a lot in it, but some of you might want some different kinds of information resources. And I wanted to point out that our Digital Media Center, where you can borrow DVDs, is right on this fourth floor on the west side, and you can borrow DVDs for a week at a time. And I have a list of five DVDs in particular that completely relate to what we're learning. This one, Quran by Heart, some of you may have seen. Some of you have seen it, but you could borrow that. There's a DVD that was produced just for this Muslim Journey series called Islamic Art Spot, so that really ties into the next session where we're going to look at the art of the Hajj. So that's something, and there are others too. So I have a brief list of DVDs. If anybody wants them, just come up to me and I'll let you know about those, okay? And I think that's it for now. I'm gonna ask Dr. Khalil to come up and we'll enjoy his lecture. Thank you.
Thank you, Deborah. All right, okay. Let's see if we remember the greeting. What is the traditional Muslim greeting? All right, assalamu alaikum. And remember, you have to say alaikum, all right? And the response is? All right, very good. Okay, so, looks like my notes, where did they go? Maybe I. That's the other way, yep. Well, the book that we read, of course, for today was The Story of the Quran by Ingrid Mattson. And I don't know about you, but I thought chapter 3 of that book was one of the best I've read out of many books, certainly in many Islamic studies books. Chapter 3 I thought was brilliant. This is the one, The Voice in the Pen, where you have Reem and her the story of how she received the ijazah, or certificate, for memorizing the Quran and for her recitation of the Quran. A brief word about the author, Ingrid Mattson. She is in many ways similar to our previous author. Both are North American converts to Islam who received their PhD from the University of Chicago. And I've had the pleasure of meeting both of them. I'll tell you a funny story about Ingrid Mattson. Ingrid Mattson was from 2006 to maybe 12 or so, was the president, roughly, was president of the largest North American Muslim organization, ISNA, which stands for the Islamic Society of North America. So back in 2010, I was invited to a meeting with the Dalai Lama. Now, it's not as if I was chatting with him. I was just invited to the meeting. And Ingrid Mattson was there. She was actually chatting with him. And after the meeting, Ingrid Mattson needed a ride to the headquarters of ISNA. So I was the only one that was heading in that direction, so I gave her a ride. And my parents are from Egypt. And I don't know if you're familiar with Egypt and the driving in Egypt. But even though I was raised here, I've adopted the Egyptian way of driving, which is crazy. And so what I was doing, I was driving, and I was holding my phone in the other hand with the GPS, and I was driving and talking to her, and you know, she grabbed my phone, and said, okay, well, let's take it from here. You're going to go, and so, you know, she's one of the nicest, don't get me wrong, one of the nicest people I've ever met, actually, and extremely open-minded and has a kind heart. Okay, so let's begin with some basic information about the Quran. First, Muslims generally take the Quran to be the word of God, not Muhammad, but God. And it's the word of God transmitted to the Prophet through the angel, Gabriel, according to the dominant understanding. And the Quran was revealed in the month of Ramadan. What does that mean exactly? That's a subject of much debate. Does that mean that the first revelation that Muhammad received in the cave was during Ramadan? Or does that mean that this is when the Quran was brought down into the earthly domain? There's some debate there. But in any case, Ramadan is the ninth month of the Islamic lunar calendar, and it's the month in which Muslims fast. And so during this month, Muslims will fast, and they will read from the Quran more than they typically do. And so it's very common here at the mosque even. During Ramadan, they'll have night prayers, and they read the entire Quran from beginning to end, you know, during the month. As for the history of the Quran, the transcription and collection of the Quran, according to our sources, the Quran was transcribed during the lifetime of the Prophet. He would recite what he had received, and he would have, according to some reports, 20 scribes. According to other reports, 40 some odd scribes, and according to some other reports, 60 some odd scribes, and they would write what he was reciting on anything they could get their hands on, bones, leather, anything they could get their hands on. You know, obviously paper was not available, although it would be a few decades later. Or several decades, we'll say. The Quran, after the Prophet dies, it is the companions of the Prophet who put it all together and establish a single volume. And then this would actually be repeated a second time, as you saw described in the book, and then the official copy, the authoritative copy, would be copied and spread, and copies of that copy were distributed throughout the empire, the rapidly expanding empire. The Quran is divided into 114 surahs. Now, in the book, and even in my own book, I define surah as chapter. But just so you know, that's not the best definition. Because, you know, when you hear the word chapter, you think, okay, so chapter 1 leads to chapter 2, and chapter 2 leads into chapter 3. With the Quran, you could think of each surah as almost a book. It's its own thing. It's its own unit. And so we use the word chapter just out of convenience. And the surahs are of various lengths. You know, some surahs are 3 lines long. Some surahs are, 2.5 out of 30. Well, it was pretty big. You know, 286 verses. The arrangement of the surahs, this is something that's interesting. Ingrid Mattson says in the text that it's arranged, with the exception of the first surah, it's arranged from longest to shortest, generally. I actually tell my students don't say that it's arranged from longest to shortest, because when you do that, there's so many counterexamples. For one thing, the shortest surah is not Surah 114, it's 108. And when you get into some of those, the 60s and the 40s and the 50s and the 60s, those surahs, I mean, some are really short, some are really long. So I tell my students to avoid the whole longest to shortest thing. So the arrangement that we have today, is that random? What is that based on? As Ingrid Mattson notes, some Muslim scholars believe that it is indeed random, that it was just, you know, this is what the scholars decided. But there's a minority that believes that the order of the surahs was also divinely ordained. And recently, there was a scholar named, I'll use the initials, A.A. Islahi, and his major, what he's known for is the argument that The surahs are actually, the surahs that are near each other are connected by certain themes and certain sayings. So he actually is of the view that there is a thematic connection between the surahs in the order in which we currently find them. But in any case, that's something that's up for debate. The names of the surahs, where do we get the names from? These are things that were basically determined, for the most part, after the Prophet's death. So you'll have surahs with different names. So for example, Surah 2, the longest surah, goes by the cow. That's how that's how you'll see it in most copies, the cow. But there's actually another name for it, and that is the big divorce surah. And that's because there's another surah called the divorce. So this is the big divorce surah. And the way these names are derived, the scholars will look for something unique in that surah, and then they'll name it. So for instance, the cow, there's a story about the cow that appears in just a few verses out of 286. And yet they call the whole surah the cow. And by the way, there's another surah called the elephant, which is significantly smaller. Okay, another surah called the ant, and then there's the bees as well. Okay. Now, as for the audience of the Quran, who is the audience? We find in the Quran some passages addressed to the Prophet directly. And if you have a good translation of the Quran, you'll know where that appears. I use Abd al-Halim, which is the Oxford University Press translation. In the Abd al-Halim translation, he'll insert in brackets Prophet when you see it in the first person, sorry, in the second person singular. So you, singular. So he inserts Prophet then, because it's obvious that it's addressed to the Prophet. Whereas if it's in the plural, then we don't see Prophet. So many passages are addressed to the Prophet. And his name only appears, how many times, who remembers from the first lecture? Four times. His name only appears four times in the entire text. And we see some passages addressed to the companions of the Prophet. We see passages addressed to the family of the Prophet. Passages addressed to the entire community of the Prophet. Some passages addressed to the enemies of the Prophet. And passages addressed to everyone in Arabia. And passages addressed to everyone, period, all of humanity. And for the person reading or listening or reciting, listening to or reciting the Quran, these narratives, or these, what we see, even if it's specific to the Prophet or to somebody in the era of the Prophet, the point is that you derive some lesson from that, just as one derives lessons from Quranic or biblical stories of Moses or Jesus. One is supposed to derive lessons from that, even if it does not necessarily pertain to their own personal life. The Quran is the most important source for scholars of Islamic law. It is the most important source for scholars of Islamic theology. And yet, the Quran doesn't get too specific when it comes to law and when it comes to theology. The Quran contains, by the standard count, 6,236 verses. Okay, 6,236 verses. Out of those, how many do you think have anything to do with law? 6,236. 150? Anybody else? Going once, going twice? Okay, well, 150 sold. All right, so most scholars historically would say there are 500 to 600, but see, when they say that, they're taking into account passages that talk about rituals, praying and so on, you know, verses that say pray. If we limit it to what we think of when we think of law, so let's say verses that deal with inheritance, verses that deal with the rules of war, verses that deal with marriage and divorce, there are only 80 verses that would qualify out of 6,236. And by the way, most of the legal passages appear in the later part of Muhammad's prophethood, when he is in Medina, when he has established a community. The earliest revelations, really, I mean, when it comes to law, you might find a passage about, you know, staying up, reciting the Quran, giving to those in need, and yeah, that's pretty much about it. It's in the last 10 years of the Prophet's life, when he's in Medina, that you get all of the law, most of the laws, the overwhelming majority And the Quran is, as it describes itself, an Arabic Quran. It is an Arabic Quran. Does that mean that you can't translate it? No, you can. And there's actually a common misconception that Muslims reject translation of the Quran. No, there is, you can translate it, but it's widely believed to be then a translation and, by extension, interpretation of the Quran. Because when you translate, of course, you are interpreting. And when you read a translation, you might read a line and might have no idea that there's actually a lot of debate about how to translate a particular word. Any translation of the Quran is seen as an interpretation of the Quran. And that's legitimate, that's fine, that's great. But when it comes to rituals, when it comes to reciting the Quran in a ritual context, there, the vast majority of Muslims believe you have to do it in the Arabic original. You don't lose anything in translation. And you preserve the form of the Quran. There's something about the form of the Quran. The way the letters sound, and you saw this in the text. The way the words sound. In fact, there's a theory that in Arabic, even letters, individual letters, have meaning. Individual letters. So for example, in Arabic, if you think of words that begin with fa, and I know most of you maybe don't know Arabic, but the words that begin with fa often involve things opening. Fataha, farraqa, and so on. And words that begin with mim, or the M sound, usually involve things coming together, like masaha. Okay? So what's interesting is that the word Arabic word for mouth is fem. You have fa for opening, and M for closing, right? Fem. I thought that was neat. Anyway, there's something to the form of the Quran as well. Okay, now let's talk about the nature of the Quran. And again, the word Quran means recitation. So this should indicate that this is something you're supposed to experience, something that you recite and something you listen to. It's oral and aural. It's an experiential book. So to give you a sense of the form of the Quran, how it sounds, I'm not a professional reciter, but let me just give you a sense of how some of the surahs sound. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم قل أعوذ برب الناس ملك الناس إله الناس من شر الوسواس الخناس الذي يوسوس في صدور الناس من الجنة والناس. Obviously you could hear the rhythm there, the rhyme. And then also listen to this. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم والشمس وضحاها والقمر إذا تلاها والنهار إذا جلاها والليل إذا يغشاها والسماء وما بناها والأرض وما طحاها ونفس وما سواها فألهمها فجورها وتقواها قد أفلح من زكاها وقد خاب من دساها. You sense the rhythm again. Listen to this. This is the end of one surah. At the end, the last three lines of a surah. إنهم يكيدون كيدا وأكيد كيدا فمهل الكافرين أمهلهم رويدا. So you see that? So you lose that with the translation. Right, you lose that with the translation. So I mean, you could see, you know, in Ramadan when Muslims are praying at night at the mosque, you might see somebody crying, and the person reciting they're reciting something about inheritance laws, something that's very legal, you know. But it's just there's something about that, the rhythm and the form of the Quran that you lose. Now that doesn't mean, because you know, historically you will find some Muslims who say that it is okay to recite in your native tongue if you're just beginning, if you're a new Muslim. One famous scholar who is reported to have said this is Abu Hanifa, who said, "Yeah, you can recite it in Persian, in Farsi, if you're new to the religion." But obviously, the preference was for Arabic, the Arabic original. And you'll notice the next term. I have a term here, hafiz or hafidh. Hafiz is how Egyptians would say it. Hafidh is how you're supposed to say it. So can you all say hafidh? Yeah, a hafiz is somebody who has memorized the entire Quran, cover to cover. And the Quran is about roughly 4/5, maybe, the size of the New Testament. But it's repetitive, and there's again, a rhythm to it. So it makes it relatively easy to memorize, relatively. And, you know, there are people here in town who have memorized the Quran. Heck, there might be somebody sitting with us today who's memorized the Quran. It's fairly common that you'll see someone who's memorized the entire Quran. And so when they do, they're called a hafiz. That's someone who has memorized the Quran. And by the way, in the old days, in you know, 14th century, common era, you would use the term hafiz for someone who memorized not just the Quran, that was a given, but someone who memorized the Quran and all of the major hadiths. That's impressive. We're talking thousands of reports of the Prophet. Okay. The Quran, as I say, is repetitive and nonlinear. Repetitive and nonlinear. So you have many things that are repeated throughout the text. And you have to imagine, again, this is something you're supposed to listen to and experience, not simply something that you read. I mean, just think about the music you listen to. Okay? We will rock you. We will rock you. We will, okay. If you're reading it, we got, but no, you're supposed to listen to it. And you feel it. Yes, we will rock you, right? It's also nonlinear. The Quran doesn't really get into details, historical narrative details. I mean, you know, if you see a name, that's a big deal. The Quran often avoids names if it doesn't, you know, if it's irrelevant to the story. And so what you have, for example, in one surah, you begin with letters, A-L-M, and there's debate as to what that means, as you saw in the text. And then you find a declaration, and you're with the Prophet and his community. Then you are in the afterlife. And then you are with Adam and Eve. And then you are with Abraham. And then you're with Moses, and so on. And all these different stories, they're tied together in some way. There's some overarching theme in sort of bringing all this together. And notice that there's a term for the written Quran, and that is the Mus'haf. Can you all say, not Mus'haf, can you say Mus'haf? Yeah, this is the written Quran. The Quran in written form. So notice there's a separate term for that. Okay, the Quranic message. I'm looking at the clock. Is it really 7:25 already? No way. Wow. Is it really? Oh, wow. Okay, well, let's do this. 10 more minutes? Okay, the Quranic message. There are three things I'd like to highlight here. The first is the idea that the notion that there is no God, but Allah. Again, Allah, the Arabic word for God. And when we think about the Quranic God, there are many misconceptions about the Quranic God, but let's just discuss some of the basic features of the Quranic God. First of all, almost every surah of the Quran, with one exception, begins with what's called the Basmala, which is a formula that is translated to, in the name of God, the Lord of mercy, the giver of mercy. Or you could translate it, the compassionate, the caring, or the beneficent, the merciful. There are different translations. This notion of, we've talked about this before, rahmah, mercy. This is the dominant attribute, this kind of loving mercy. And it's a term related to the word for the womb of the mother, the rahim. And we see in the Quran numerous names of God. And from how the Quran describes God, we get things like this, decorative lists of the 99 names of God. Okay? And I'll leave all the images I show you up here. And these names convey the nature, they tell us about the nature of God. So we read in the Quran that He is God, the compassionate, the caring, the creator, the shaper, the first, the last, the vast, the victorious, the glorious, the great, the light, the living, the loving, the forgiving, the finder, the firm, the affirming, the abaser, the exalter, the enricher, the rich, the real, the just, the judge, the patient, the propitious, the illustrious, the incomparable, the noble, the holy, the one, and so on. And as for the nature of God, we see that God created the universe and mounted the throne. So we imagine God is above us. But then we also read that God is closer to people than their, we'll translate it as, jugular vein. And we read that everywhere you turn, there is the face of God. We also, as for the gender of God, the Quran says explicitly, خَلَقَ الذَّكَرُ وَالْأُنْثَى, God created the male and the female. So it's actually considered blasphemous to say God is a male or God is a female, even though the dominant attributes relate to the womb of the mother, right? Okay. The Prophet Muhammad is one in a long line of prophets, and we've talked about this before. Moses, Abraham, Jesus, they're all seen as special prophets. Jesus in particular, I'll just say something about Jesus because this is something people often wonder about. Jesus is considered a special prophet. The Quran seems to point to speaks of his birth as a virgin birth, a miraculous conception. That's at least according to the dominant reading. It describes his miracles and some miracles that we don't find in the canonical gospels, and in the official Bible, but we find them in maybe in other or versions of them in other gospels, like the Gospel of Thomas and Peter and so on, infancy gospel. And we see the crucifixion. The Quran says in a very brief passage in Surah 4 that the Jews of Jerusalem did not crucify Jesus, nor did they kill him, but it was made to appear that way. So what does that mean? For most Muslims, it means he was saved somehow. For a minority of Muslims historically, it meant simply that, he was crucified, but God saved him just as he would save a martyr, that their soul is saved. But for the majority of Muslims, if you were to ask them, the majority believe that he actually was completely saved from the crucifixion. So it depends on how you read that passage, ultimately, and how you read some of the hadiths, and whether you accept those hadiths. And the third item is that there are consequences for our decisions in this life. And here's where we get the concept of the afterlife. If someone tells you, I read the Quran, but I didn't come across a reference to the afterlife, they haven't read the Quran. They haven't read the Quran. The Quran is replete with references to the afterlife. But what's interesting is the Quran says that your creation and your resurrection are like a single being. So there's a connection between this life and the next in some way. And when we read the Quranic descriptions of the afterlife, it's very interesting. Hell is hot, and whereas paradise is nice, it's cool, it's not extremely hot and it's not extremely cold, the Quran tells us. And by the way, there is a concept of an extremely cold hell, and that's called Zemherir, which we find out more about in the Hadith corpus, or just look outside the window. No, I'm just kidding. But what's interesting about all these descriptions is these are all approximations. There's a famous hadith in which the prophet says, and again, a hadith is a report about the prophet. There's a hadith in which he says that heaven has what no eye has seen, no ear has heard. Sounds a lot like Paul in Corinthians, right? So there's this idea that all these descriptions are just approximations. And the ultimate pleasure, the ultimate joy one gets in the afterlife is not having all these fruits and all these rivers. It's knowing that God is pleased with you. That is the ultimate pleasure of paradise. Okay. Finally, let me just mention the first surah of the Quran. This is really the heart of the Quran. Al-Fatiha, the opening chapter. Let me recite it. Listen to the rhythm and I'll translate it because I think you have to really understand the Quran, you have to know this surah. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين الرحمن الرحيم مالك يوم الدين إياك نعبد وإياك نستعين اهدنا الصراط المستقيم صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين. And here many Muslims will say Amin, Amen, right? What does it mean? In the name of God, the compassionate, the caring, all praise is due to God, the compassionate, the caring, Lord of the worlds. Oh, hold on, Master of the Day of Judgment, excuse me. Master of the Day of Judgment. It is you we worship, and it is your aid that we seek. Guide us to the straight path, the path of those you have blessed. not of those who are objects of anger, nor of those who are astray. Amen. And this is comparable to the Lord's Prayer in a Christian context. Okay, finally, Quranic art. Whew. Okay, I'll try to fly through this. Quranic art and architecture. The way the Quran is written becomes an art form. The calligraphy becomes an art form. So let me just show you some images of the evolution of the Quranic text. Here is an image of one of the earliest texts that we have. Okay? One of the earliest texts that we have of the Quran. And again, I'll leave these images up here. Okay? Here is a later, this is what's called a Kufic Quran. This is the next stage in the evolution of the Quranic text. What's her name, Vanna? Okay. All right. Here is the next stage where you see dots, short vowels, for those who are maybe not familiar with Arabic. And then we see more elaborate artwork with the calligraphy, the Quranic word as art. And so when you go into a mosque, you won't see images of famous Muslims, you'll see images of words, maybe representing those Muslims, like the Prophet, if you're in a Sunni mosque, the first four caliphs, and maybe the Prophet's grandsons, Hassan and Hussein. If you're in a Shiite context, you might see Ali, the fourth caliph. As well as the Prophet, of course. Here are some more elaborate designs. Walk a little bit quickly here for the time. Another interesting design. And here you see, they might avoid depicting living creatures in many cases, but here you see that one person trying to get around that. And then here you see the Quranic text printed, in this modern age, right, with a printing press, not by hand. Okay, this is the kind you'll see in most mosques today. And then you see somebody here listening, using an iPad or an iPod, and he's reading from the text. And if we think of the Quran as something you experience, then wouldn't the iPod be really the Quran, and what he's looking at is just the Mus'haf? You could argue. Okay. And then finally, let me just sneak in really quickly a really good recitation of the Quran. This is what was referred to in the book as an elaborate recitation. And this is by the most famous reciter of all time, or of the 20th century, Abdul Basit. And he's an Egyptian reciter, very well known. This is a little ghetto, I know, but it's okay. Notice you feel each letter. You feel each letter in the recitation. Okay, with that, we better end. Thank you so much. Oh, and this time, I'm just going to pop in. I'm just going to jump in. I won't even sit down, so I can make sure I get every group. I'll just stand, answer some questions, and I'll leave. Thank you so much. Thank you. Oh, and I'll leave these images up here again, as I said.
On some of the questions that dealt with recitations, yes. One of the things I noticed in the one you had on your phone was the way he held his hands.
Yeah.
Is that
unique
to him?
It's rare. And there are people who certainly imitate him. Is he the first to do that? I doubt it. But yeah, the whole point is that you're playing with the sound. You know, if I go like this, if I move my hand, it affects the sound, right? So, and he was really a master of the sound. It was really amazing, actually.
That was the main purpose. Was
exactly. Yep.
So that was interesting.
Mm-hmm. Okay, assalamu alaikum. I guess it's a good sign that people don't want to leave their groups. That's good. Okay. All right. So let me address some of the questions I received while visiting the various groups. One question was, is what are the differences in the different, you know, the book mentions the 10 orthodox recitations of the Quran. Do you remember this? The 10 orthodox recitations. So there was a question, you know, how different are these recitations? How do they vary from one another? So typically it's just the sound or maybe a letter or a vowel. So let me just give you a sample. The way that most recite it, the first chapter of the Quran, they would recite this verse as, one verse as, Maliki Yawmiddin, which means owner of the day of judgment. God is the owner of the day of judgment. Another reading is Maliki Yawmiddin, which would be translated as King of the Day of Judgment. So we have owner of the Day of Judgment, King of the Day of Judgment. It really doesn't affect the meaning, but it's a variant. It's another way of reciting it. Sometimes the different recitations, they'll just sound different. The meaning will be the same, it just sounds different. So for example, the way most people read Surah 93 is like this. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. وَالضُّحَى وَاللَّيْلِ إِذَا سَجَى. But here's how some recite it. وَالضُّحَى وَاللَّيْلِ إِذَا سَجَى. Sometimes it's just the sound. Another question. How are discrepancies in Quranic translation resolved? Do these discrepancies cause a significant divide among Muslims in how they worship or follow their religion? Muslims agree on the basics. You know, there's one God. You know, you should worship God. There is an afterlife. You know, there are prophets. But they also disagree on a lot of many things. When it comes to, you know, legal matters, certain theological matters. And so, yeah, there are many disagreements, many different points of view. And how do they resolve it? I mean, argument, I guess. Debate, discourse. There's no formal orthodoxy in either Sunni or Shiite Islam, but there's at least an informal orthodoxy, and that is the orthodoxy of the recognized scholars. And so it is in their debates and their discussions and in their fatwas, their scholarly opinions, that issues are resolved, at least at the scholarly level, and not necessarily for each individual Muslim. Okay, let's open the floor for questions, and if you have note cards, please feel free to pass them up. Yeah.
I'm wondering if you could flesh out this idea of the 99
names of God.
I think that's really kind of interesting.
Yeah.
It's kind of pluralizing and
right.
Giving God this
different dimensions of God.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, the 99 names of God. So there's a hadith in which the Prophet says that there are 99 names of God that we know of. And there are other names that we don't know. And what's interesting about the most, you know, there are actually different versions of that list, but there is one that's pretty popular. And what's interesting about the one that's really popular is that it includes names that are actually not in the Quran, but are derived from the Quran. I'll give you a simple example. Ad-Dar, which means the harmer. The Quran never calls God the harmer. It uses the verb, yudir, but it never calls him the harmer, ad-dar. For some theologians, that's significant. In fact, in my own research, I was reading the work of a scholar named Ibn Taymiyyah and his student Ibn Qayyim al-Jawziyyah, scholars who have a reputation of being traditionalist, conservative scholars. And they believed that never in the Quran is God referred to as something that would necessitate chastisement or punishment. God is called the forgiving, the compassionate, but he's never called al-mu'adhib, the punisher, or al-mu'aqib, which also could be the punisher. And it only uses verbs. It does refer to him as avenging things, but on the day of judgment. So their big thing is it never says God is el something and then something that would necessitate punishment. Even the terms that, one term that comes up is al-jabbar, which is like the compeller, but that, even that wouldn't necessarily, it wouldn't necessitate chastisement. So in any case, there are some scholars today who have come up with an alternative 99 name list, and they claim it's only straight from the Quran. They claim if you look at the Quran, there actually are 99 names, and so, but that list is not nearly as popular as this one, the one that you'll see in most homes. Yeah. Yeah.
There's some sort of a debate about names and attributes.
Yeah.
Could you expand on that? Maybe for the benefit of others, because there's a debate.
Maybe you could expand what you have in mind.
The attributes, you know, as opposed to names. Because the names then get...
The theological debates?
Yeah.
Yeah. With the Mu'tazilites and all that?
Right.
Yeah. Oh, boy, that's a big one.
Well,
that is a big one.
I didn't mean...
Yeah, no, that's fine. The Greek-inspired, we'll say Greek-inspired theologians, the theologians who were inspired by Greek thought, they, for them... Only God could be eternal, and everything else is created or in time. So there was this big discussion about, you know, are God's attributes eternal, or are they created or uncreated? That whole this goes back to the whole debate of whether the Quran is created or uncreated. You know, we might think, what's the big deal? But it actually, there are major implications there. So I think for the sake of time, I'll just leave it at that. But it is an interesting discussion. It is an interesting debate. Yeah. Yeah.
My question again about the recitation. Maybe others would be interested in that too. On page 80 in the book, I looked. The American girl, or young lady, she at age 12, she had memorized the complete Quran by memory, section by section, to her teachers. A remarkable feat, reciting at a moderate pace, it would take at least a full day and night, 24 hours, to recite the whole Quran. And again, I just can't grasp that. I mean, some of us memorize poems in school, a couple minutes? This is hours? How typical is this? It says a moderate pace. I mean, can some people speed through in 9 hours?
Oh, yeah.
Nine hours?
I'll tell you what. You know, there are some recitations that would actually, it would probably take them 3 days to read the Quran. If you remember the thing that you listened to on my cell phone, with that recitation, I mean, you know, it's very slow. But there's, the Saudi style of recitation is very quick. And I'm sure they could fly through it in less than 24 hours. So yeah, there are different paces. As for just the size of the Quran, and I mean, you have to imagine these are people devoting years of their lives to this, right? And you know, as I say, there are people here in East Lansing who have memorized the whole Quran. You know, the imam of the mosque here, 23 years old, he knows the whole thing.
How long would it take him, do you think?
You know, it varies from person to person. Maybe, I don't know if somebody knows his background at Tahsin, if you know how long it took him to memorize.
To recite
will vary. I mean, that will depend on the pace. And you know, as we discussed during the group, you know, it's not as if someone would recite continuously without breaking ever, because you have the five prayers, you have, you know, natural needs that people have to deal with. But you know, you in Ramadan especially, you have people who are in the mosque reading the entire Quran. Maybe it takes them 3 days, you know, and they're going through it. And, you know, if they can read quickly, if they're speed readers, they might do it in a day and, you know, less than 24 hours. So it varies from person to person. Tahsin, do you have a sense of how long it took the imam to memorize the Quran?
I didn't ask the current imam, but the previous imam had learned it by himself without any assistance.
Yeah.
In less than a year's time.
Less than a year, wow. He must have photographic memory. Yeah, I mean, there's some people who are pretty sharp.
And he was 18 years old at that time.
18, wow. Yeah, you know, they say that if you were to burn all the copies of the Quran, it'd be no problem. You just get a bunch of 12-year-olds in a room, and there you have it. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. you know, there's a famous hadith there are actually multiple hadiths, but we have these hadiths where people are complaining to the Prophet about, maybe in one case it's a woman complaining about her husband who's always in the mosque. And then another report, it's, you know, a man says, I'm just going to be in the mosque all day. And the Prophet, in both cases, rebukes the man. No, you have to take breaks and be part of society and do things. Yeah. Yeah.
we read in our book, or there is a mention of the devil. And also there's a comment that sometimes the devil was associated with the jinn. Would you talk about the devil in the context of the Muslim religion, and where do the Muslims think the devil came from?
Right. So the Quran refers to the devil, we'll say Iblis, Satan, and the story, the way he's introduced is God commands the angels to bow to Adam, and they obey. Iblis, the devil, does not obey. And we find a clarification in a later surah that he was of the jinn. The word jinn is interesting. It actually can mean many things. It was a word used by the Arabs to mean something that's strange, something foreign, something unusual, something hidden. And the going understanding is that the jinn are unseen. They're unseen beings. And so, and they are created out of smokeless fire, is how the Quran describes it, smokeless fire. So they're not typically considered fallen angels. They're considered a separate group. Again, typically. You'll find some exceptions historically, but typically, that's how they're considered. And so they're seen as a separate group from the angels. The angels are seen as always perfect. They're always doing the right thing. They're almost like automatons, whereas the jinn, you get the sense that they can choose to be good or evil. And again, they're unseen. So what does that mean? For some Muslims, the jinn can occupy people's bodies. They're maybe in this room with us right now. For other Muslims, the jinn might be just they're unseen and we don't know. We're not going to ask questions. We're not going to worry about it. For other Muslims, it's maybe a metaphor. I mean, you know, you get some, you know, modernist Muslims see it as they're just metaphors for other things. So, you know, you'll find a spectrum of interpretations of the jinn and of Satan, as you would find in other traditions, certainly Christianity. Yeah. Yeah. The jinn can be good or evil. The jinn can be good or evil. And actually, the Quran even refers to the jinn listening to the Quran and then becoming righteous after listening to the Quran, or a group of jinn, I should say. So you get references to, you know, good jinn and evil jinn. And I'll say this, you know, something that's unique to Muslims is that when you get a bunch of kids together at a camp, they'll tell all kinds of jinn stories, like ghost stories, right? Other questions?
So are you saying that Muslims accept, in essence, what the Christians do in relative to Satan's being a fallen angel?
Well, not the fallen angel concept. The angels are seen as, you know, they don't fall, basically. The devil is, so the jinn are, you could have fallen jinn. Yeah, so in that case, yeah, he's fallen jinn. But, you know, again, I want to clarify that we're talking here about the majority interpretation. There is actually a small minority, historically, that thought of the jinn as indeed fallen angels. They would say that the angels are made out of light, and the jinn are made out of smokeless fire, and the fire is a form of light, and they would go that route. But again, that's a small minority. For the vast majority, it's a separate group, and, you know, they would just leave it at that.
Yeah. What about hell?
Hell. After our fifth book discussion, we have a separate lecture on salvation and Islamic thought. And that's the subject of my book. And that's what I'll talk about hell. Yeah. And don't worry, it won't be as grim as you might imagine it to be. The lecture, not hell. Yeah.
I really get confused about this. Just a quick definition difference between the Sunnis and the Shiites.
Sure. The big difference comes down to this one question. How do you preserve the integrity of the religion in the absence of the Prophet? For Sunnis, you look to the community. For Shiites, initially, you look to an imam, a leader, who is an infallible guide. And again, this is for the majority of Shiites. And, of course, the 12th leader is an occultation. So now, in the absence of that leader, they begin to rely on the scholars in the absence of the imam. Yeah. So it's really about, you know, who has religious authority after the prophet.
Can they all
get along
in the same mosque?
You know, for many, yes. For many, for others, no. The mosque here in East Lansing, you'll have Sunnis and Shiites in the congregation. Most of the people who give the sermons are Sunni, but in fact, I think vast majority, maybe all, I don't know, but the congregation is Sunni and Shiite. Yeah, you'll have Shiites. And actually, I remember even growing up in our Sunday school, we had somebody in our class who was from Iran, and, you know, it's very, very common, yeah. Either one.
We had a discussion in our group about how to use human reason to understand Quran, whether it's enough, whether we are actually capable of understanding it. Is there any specific reference in Quran that we are given the reason to be able to understand Quran? Or
the Quran again and again will ask this question, أَفَلَا يَعْقِلُونَ. Don't they use their reason? Don't they use their mind? So the use of the intellect is stressed in the Quran, but what do we do that? How do we use the intellect then? What is our criteria? You could read the Quran and you could feel something is true, something that you come up with an interpretation that makes sense to you. But now when you come speak with me, I might not see what you're seeing. So then how in our public discourse, how do we convey ideas? How do we argue for point for particular positions? It's in this public discourse where you're going to encounter conflict and challenges, because we don't see eye to eye necessarily. And then when you think about cultural differences, and I mean, you know, what's right, what's wrong, what's morally right, what's morally wrong, this varies from culture to culture. Heck, it varies even in this culture from decade to decade or from year to year. Arriving at having a standard language that we can all accept, that's difficult to maintain or to, what's the word? I think I'm getting to the point where I'm thinking about spring break right now. No, it's complicated. I'll leave it at that.
Yes. I just have a quick to add. In the Sunni Shia, I mean, I know lots of intermarriages.
Oh, sure.
And so then...
Yeah. My father-in-law is actually married to a Lebanese Shiite woman,
And in Iraq, I met people. And so then, what about the children? I've always been kind of curious.
Yeah, well, I guess they would just have to pick one, right? Yeah, I mean, it's... or there could be sushi. There could be sushi, right? I don't know. That's something that you see, yeah. I've heard Muslims say that they're sushi. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you so much,
thank you
Professor
so much. Thank
Khalil,
you.
Thank and you. Thank you, everyone. We'll see you in 2 weeks with this Art of the Hajj.